This is Real History with Melissa, and I am Melissa, and I think this is going to go up on Boxing Day, December 26, 2025. And it's a holiday in the UK based on taking your leftovers, boxing them up, and sharing them with people who are in need, who don't have the luxuries and the foods items and the Christmas celebration that we have. And I think it's a nice holiday. I think in the US, if there's a holiday after the day of Christmas, it's probably go spend money on the day after Christmas and buy a bunch of stuff you don't need. So I was going to be doing this today with Nick. We were going to try to finish up that Hideous Strength. And he retrieved a friend from the airport last night. Their flight was delayed by several hours, and he got home in the wee middle of the night, the wee hours. And he already has a baby in the house. So this is sleep deprivation on top of sleep deprivation. And so a bit ago, he said, "Would it be just horrible if we rescheduled a week?" And I said, "No, it wouldn't be. But Nick, I washed my hair and I curled it." And that's kind of this running joke, is that I'm not big on spending time grooming. So I said, "I can't let this grooming go to waste. I am going to do something with it." And I told Nick what I had in mind, because my supplementary reading and listening around the material, I was excited to have something to share. And it really, Nick has the preamble ramble. And it can't be a preamble ramble because we're already two-thirds of the way through the material. So maybe it's a mid-ramble amble or a late ramble amble. And he thought it was a good idea. He said, "Look, we only got to, I think we're a few pages into chapter 12, which I wanted to go to last time, because then we get into the macrobes. These viral worm kind of creatures." And so we still have a few chapters to go. I think it's going to go pretty quickly once we get going. But there were some things in the reading that I wanted to highlight for you, actually highlight quite a bit. And when I shared this with Nick, he said, "Go for it. No grooming should go to waste, and it would add too much time to our covering the material." But before I get started on this, I wanted to share just a couple of things. In the new year, I'll be back with Neil Foster on a regular basis. He's had a break. I can't really call it a break. He's working very hard, as he always does this time of the year. And there are some other people. I'm going to speak with Blue, and I'm looking forward to that. She's a homesteader, lovely, really like her. I met her husband, who's a longtime listener to Alan Watt, we did a Zoom a few weeks ago, and I also met her daughter, and they homeschool their daughter. And she's lovely. So this is my shout out to Olivia, who said, "When are we going to talk again?" So there will be new things in the new year. It isn't just books, but we are going to finish up that Hideous Strength. Now, this is heavily marked, and I haven't even finished marking it for the last bit of it. But again, got some things here moving off the camera that I want to talk about. I know that actually a good handful of you have shared that you are reading along. You've read the C.S. Lewis novels and the Ransom trilogy, the Cosmic trilogy, and are enjoying that. And I wanted to share with you that the next book that we are doing is Philip K. Dick. Can you see that? I think you can. Philip K. Dick, A Scanner Darkly. Now, it is helpful in some material to be reading the same version. However, Nick and I have not found it challenging to do this on different versions. Now, Nick in his members book club is covering political Ponerology. It's really good, and I hope I get caught up. I'm a chapter behind on that, but this is good, and this is one where I am reading an older version, and it's been quite updated with a lot of new material. And I think Nick has made that available over at his book club, and I just haven't gotten it downloaded or gotten on the in the groove with that. But anyway, back to Philip K. Dick, great sci-fi writer, Alan Watts' favorite sci-fi writer. And we read together a lot of his novels and short stories. And of course, we've seen many of his movies. Blade Runner was one of his. I think that was the first that was turned into a movie. But A Scanner Darkly is not one that Alan and I saw because it's kind of not really super big fans on the animated type or, the drawn out scenario. It does have real actors in it, and it actually has Alex Jones featured in it, but we never saw that. And but I am going to try to watch the movie version of A Scanner Darkly. Now, as to books, you don't have to spend a lot of money. You can see that this is a library book. See, it's not, though, a checked out current library book. It's one I got in the next town over for free because they were dumping it. So if you are really interested in books, you can find them without spending money, as I did here. So that we will cover in the new year, and it's quick. It's about 200 pages, and I'm looking forward to that. Now, the next thing, oh, Nick just finished on his live streams, Brzezinski's Between Two Ages, and he is starting next in the new year. Foundations, Their Power and Influence by Renée A. Wurmser. And this is a book that Alan Watt talked about a lot. And I have been reminded of this book over and over again in reading That Hideous Strength. And so, yeah, books are good. I think that's my plug for books. So, what I got into, there are a couple of things that I wanted to mention in this mid-ramble ramble. Mid-amble. I'm sorry. I'm confusing myself. Oh, but first I have to say, besides doing my hair, I got the Judy scarf out because I figured, oh, Nick will probably wear his scarf again. Because it is cold today. We had a couple of days of heat up into the 80s Fahrenheit, and but we're da back down to winter weathers. And these are my new wrist warmers that Gabrielle knitted for me. I think they're so beautiful, and I wanted to show them off. They are keeping me warm, though. They're very practical but pretty. And she said that these are, oh, I hope I get it right. I think these are merino wool. Anyway, they're very lovely. These might be alpaca, though. She sent me two pair. They're really nice, but I can't remember which is alpaca and which is merino. So now I said it both. I said it both ways. But thank you for that. So the title, That Hideous Strength, where does the title come from? Let's just get right into that. I've pulled up a few pages. And I'll see what I can share with you if I can find them. This is from a poem. Now, it's a poem by Sir David Lindsay, and it was written in 1555. And Sir David Lindsay was Scottish. He was writing at the time of the Reformation in Scotland. He was one of the early readers of Tyndale's translation of the Bible when it came to Scotland, advocated to get it into the hands of the people, and was a supporter of John Knox and the Protestant Reformation. The Tower in Ain Dialogue. Okay, so what is the Tower? And the tower is the Tower of Babel, or Babel, as some people say it, but I'll stick with Babel. So the title, That Hideous Strength, is taken from this poem. And sorry to the Scots people, but I'll mess it up. Ain dialogue betwixt experience and ain courtier of the miserable estate of the world. And that is sometimes called, I think the monarch is shortened to it, but I don't have that up in front of me. So C.S. Lewis took these two lines, this couplet from the poem. The shadow of that hideous strength, sex mile and more it is of length. Okay, what is that hideous strength? That is the Tower of Babel. The shadow of that hideous strength, sex, that's 6 mile and more it is of length. So here, just reading a little bit, this is coming from Pastor Jeremiah. I have no idea who he is, but he said, it is very fitting that Lewis chose to connect the events of his story to the symbolism of this poem. The connection may not be obvious at first, but if you look at the events Lindsay was commenting on in his writing, and even the point of the story of Babel in scripture, it becomes quite clear. Now, I don't want to give much away because Nick and I will, the Tower of Babel and its significance, a lot of the significance is going to come clear towards the very end in the next to the last chapter. But this, I'm not giving anything away if I share this. There is no physical tower in Lewis's story, but there is an edifice to human pride and arrogance in the organization called the NICE. This organization is made up of military, the NICE police, scientific, Philostrato, Alcazan, et al., political, Divine, Wither, and religious, Reverend Strake. People who have come together and built a symbolic tower. This tower casts a shadow wider and blacker than any earthly tower could possibly manage and succeeds where the engineers of Babel failed, for it reaches into heaven itself and connects with the gods who call themselves the Macrobes. So I am just quickly, I did not have this pulled up, but I did stumble across this here when I was doing a little bit of reading and research. There is an organization in the UK that was established in April 1999, and it is NICE, the NICE. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. NICE is an executive non-departmental public body of the Department of Health and Social Care in the United Kingdom. Established in April 1999 as the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. Now, so it was clinical, but now it's care excellence. I guess clinical is too big a word nowadays. That's why reading is important. NICE operates as the, oh, it has expanded its responsibilities as of 2013, April 1, April Fool's, which now includes social care. That's kind of ominous. What is social care? NICE operates as the National Health Technology Assessment Body for England, responsible for judging the cost effectiveness of medicines, treatments, and technologies. We saw a bit of that during that hideous operation that we lived through a few years ago, which I sometimes call Operation C, and making recommendations for their use within the NHS. Its primary functions include producing evidence-based guidance on clinical practice, technology appraisals, public health, and social care. Well, I'll post something and you can look into the real knives yourselves. Now, I got to, in my reading, I got to chapter 14, which is called Real Life is Meeting. And right at the second page, or the be near the beginning of that chapter, Mark is having a conversation with Frost. They're talking about the macrobes. And Frost said, if one insists on putting the question in those terms, okay, let's see, let's back up. What was the question? Mark has asked a question. I think at this point he's in prison. I think we got there last time, and he's imprisoned and he's being played with, mentally. All right. He did not quite understand what he in particular, or humanity in general, stood to gain by cooperation with the macrobes. This is an important point. He saw clearly that the motives on which most men act, and which they dignify by the names of patriotism or duty to humanity, were mere products of the animal organism, varying according to the behavior pattern of different communities. Okay, so that's a scientific, you could even call it evolutionary thinking there. But he did not yet see what was to be substituted for these irrational motives. On what ground henceforward were actions to be justified or condemned? And this is kind of interesting too, because if we take evolutionary thinking that we're evolving towards something, wouldn't you think by this point, by the mid-20th century, that man, if man indeed were evolving, would have evolved past irrationality? Frost said, if one insists on putting the question in those terms, I think Waddington has given the best answer. Existence is its own justification. The tendency to develop mental change, which we call evolution, is justified by the fact that it is a general characteristic of biological entities. The present establishment of contact between the highest biological entities and the macrobes is justified by the fact that it is occurring, and it ought to be increased because an increase is taking place. So here, Frost is putting himself and his peers there in the highest biological entities who have established contact with the macrobes. And this will become clearer when Nick and I cover next week the conclusion of the novel. Mark said, you think then that there would be no sense in asking whether the general tendency of the universe might be in the direction we should call bad? And Frost said, there could be no sense at all. The judgment you are trying to make turns out on inspection to be simply an expression of emotion. Okay, now this is important because we will learn in the next few chapters that they are trying to get Mark to a place of pure objectivity. And then he goes on, Frost continues. Huxley himself could only, sorry, my chair was squeaking and I had to isolate the sound in my head. And what is squeaking? What's that noise? Huxley himself could only express it by using emotive terms such as gladiatorial or ruthless. I am referring to the famous Romanes lecture. When the so-called struggle for existence is seen simply as an actuarial theorem, we have, in Waddington's words, a concept as unemotional as a definite integral, and the emotion disappears. With it disappears that preposterous idea of an external standard of value which the emotion produced. And Mark continued the thought here. He said, and the actual tendency of events would still be self-justified and, in that sense, good when it was working for the extinction of all organic life as it presently will. And Frost said, of course. If you insist on formulating the problem in those terms, in reality, the question is meaningless. It presupposes a means and end pattern of thought which descends from Aristotle, who in his turn was merely hypostatizing elements in the experience of an Iron Age agricultural community. Motives are not the causes of action, but its byproducts. You're merely wasting your time by considering them. So Frost is trying to get towards total efficiency. That's the eliminating anything subjective, eliminating anything emotional. But what really leaped out of me there, of course, was Huxley, just the name Huxley. Huxley could only express it by using emotive terms such as gladiatorial or ruthless. I am referring to the famous Romaine's lectures. Those Romaine's lectures may be famous to some, but they're not famous to me. So I had to do some digging and find out what the Romaine lecture was. And the Romaine lecture started, it was named after, I think it's George Romaine's. Yeah. The lecture series was founded and named after the biologist George Romaines and has been running since 1892. Over the years, many notable figures from the arts and sciences have been invited to speak. Okay, so the very first lecture was William Ewart Gladstone. He was Prime Minister of the UK for 12 years. He was an academic, a liberal statesman, and he gave the inaugural Romaine's lecture, and it was called An Academic Sketch. Well, who was the very following year, 1893? That was Thomas Henry Huxley, and he delivered a speech called Evolution and Ethics. And however, that didn't exactly answer my question, because as I scrolled down the Romaine's lecture, I saw that 50 years later, in 1943, Julian Huxley delivered a lecture called Evolutionary Ethics. So then I had to go digging around, and interestingly, that took me some effort to find those lectures, particularly Julian Huxley's lecture. Now, Julian Huxley is the brother of Aldous Huxley. He was the founder of UNESCO. If he didn't coin, he popularized the term transhumanism. But let's start with Thomas Huxley, his grandfather. And as we know from Alan Watt, Thomas Huxley, well, I think that it was known before that, but Alan surely reminded us quite often that Thomas Huxley was known as Darwin's, that's Charles Darwin, Charles Darwin's bulldog, Darwin's bulldog, because he was fiercely passionate about advocating Darwin's theory of evolution. So that's Thomas Huxley, and he delivered the second Romaine's lecture. Julian Huxley and transhumanism. Julian Huxley is the evolutionary biologist. And I'm going to see here if I can do a screen share. I'm not good at these little whistles and bells, but I'm going to try it. I don't know what that'll look like, but Julian Huxley, the evolutionary biologist and intellectual, is widely regarded as the founder of transhumanism after he popularized the term in a 1957 essay titled Transhumanism. In this work, he described transhumanism as the idea that humanity could transcend itself, not just sporadically through individual efforts, but as a species in its entirety, by consciously guiding its own evolution through science and technology. Huxley envisioned a future where humans would move beyond their biological limitations, realizing new possibilities of human nature through both technological enhancement and social progress. Huxley's concept of transhumanism was rooted in a series of humanistic ideals and evolutionary theory, viewing humans as a work in progress, capable of sharing their own destiny. So this was a society, social belief. Humanity had entered a new phase. He believed that humanity had entered a new phase of evolution, the consciously purposive phase, where it could take responsibility for directing evolution, replacing natural selection with deliberate, rational planning. Okay, this is very important because it's not humanity that gets involved in planning future. We can plan our future, what do I want to study for? What kind of work do I want to do? What Julian Huxley is talking about really is the nice, a group of us, the experts, the academics. We are going to shape your future for you. We're going to decide what's best. So, because of that, because of how difficult it was for me to find, particularly Julian Huxley's essay that he delivered, his lecture at the Romaines Lectures, it is embedded within a book of his, and I did find it on archive.org. Thomas Huxley's lecture was a little bit easier to find because it was linked to directly off the wiki page on the Romaines Lectures. I went over to YouTube to see if anyone had done an audio reading of these lectures, and no one has. And so I am going to do that because I think it's important. This is really why I read, why Alan read, is it finding truth and understanding reality. And Nick Hayes's Hayes Reviews is called Truth in Books. Is all the truth there? No, it has to be your own experience and your own perceptions. That's very important. But what we find in the world of academia is that they have been, well, probably since its inception, if school, skala, comes from the Greek word for leisure, and only a leisure class is going to be able to study in such great depth, and really only for the joy of studying, then it's not for everybody. So, but I like the idea that some of you are really interested in learning and knowing and discovering as much as you can. And this is one of the things that I wanted to say about C.S. Lewis, this series of books, The Inklings, Alan Watt. And see, Alan, his idea was that we had to think for ourselves, that the moment that we let, that we just give that over to someone else, is the moment then that someone has access to our mind and they can implant, steer, indoctrinate. And he spent a lot of years touching on the idea of a deviant priesthood. Now, what did he mean by that? Who are they? Well, we follow him down through time. You'll really find that in the Cutting Through series of books quite clearly laid out. But he says in these books that they have created religion. Now, what Alan says right off the bat in the Cutting Through books is that we are created. And he brings up some interesting ideas. This is again in the series Waiting for the Miracle that we've been covering in the CGTN book club, that we are created. There are a lot of people who have tried to reconcile the theory, and remember, the theory of evolution is a theory. So they have tried to reconcile that theory with Christianity and creation by things like ideal design, etc. So that's outside the scope of what I'm talking about with you today. But it is to say that Alan in his books is saying, we are created. This is a miracle. To accept that, to see that, is the beginning of understanding life. What comes in to get between you and God is a priesthood. And every religion has its own priesthood that they are given and their own dogmas. And then you're born into that. This is why the more that you know, the more that you understand, then, well, the better, right? Because you could even understand that poem where C.S. Lewis got the lines on the hideous strength, that hideous strength. This is coming from someone in Scotland who is very much invested in the Protestant Reformation, wants to bring people a particular Bible, and that's going to have a particular slant to it. And we know, if we've studied any history at all, what kind of horrors were done by Henry VIII. Just wiping out of Catholicism, the theft of property, the killing of priests and nuns because, he wanted his marriage annulled, right? He wanted a fertile woman and he was willing to do anything for that end. So, of course, you have a very different worldview and mindset when you see the world through the lens of a Catholic worldview as opposed to a Protestant worldview. But understanding the history of it and always seeing who is the priesthood that brought us that. And one of the reasons that I'm talking about that is, you see, I obviously didn't know C.S. Lewis. So I can only gauge his character or his motives and by his words and his works. Same thing with anybody else who was associated with the Inklings. I'm going to get up and have a bit of a break here for a moment and then return to you. Okay, so I think that I was talking about people I don't know, and therefore I don't know their motives. But we can look into and see associations and have some ideas. And so that's really all I'm talking about. I think I'm talking about religion, really, as it pertains to the Inklings. The Inklings were an informal literary discussion group that centered around C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, Lord of the Rings. And there were a lot of people that were in that orbit. There were academics and mostly literary, but there were also some scientific people. This is important too, because you can see when you're reading C.S. Lewis, particularly these three novels, the exposure that he has had to the scientific thinking of that day. That's why he's showing his revulsion around the idea of vivisection, dissection of live animals so that you can study the reactions to whatever it is. It's disgusting. But he would be, as all academics of that level are, at the to have access to the cutting edge thinking. Now, why does this matter? Well, again, I mean, these conversations are months long, and I encourage us all to join with Nick Hayes when he gets into Foundations, Their Power and Influence. I have mentioned before that I heard Alan Watt talk about that book. He talked about it a lot. He referenced it. He read a few things from it, but he talked about the book a lot, and I had never read it until a couple of years ago. And it's really, for me, it was mind-blowing because I could understand so much more about how we got to where we are. And so in terms of social sciences and woke and critical race theory, these offshoot, you could call them offshoots of postmodernism. And I may today even link to, I've mentioned this recently, Bishop Williamson and his modernism lectures. So it's important. Not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Did the Enlightenment bring us a lot of good discoveries and thought? Yes. But it's good to see the trajectory. And clearly, postmodernism has brought us the likes of, well, where we are now. So I think that there's a lot of room to go into ideas when Nick is covering Foundations, Their Power and Influence. It may even occur to him to dive into people like Michel Foucault, who had such a profound influence on the social sciences and critical race theory and feminism. This is a postmodern thinker. So this is what the Academy brings us. This is what C.S. Lewis was writing about in The Abolition of Man back in, I think, 1943 was the year that that was published, which was the kind of the nonfiction ideas that he was writing about in That Hideous Strength. So, but again, back to religion and the Inklings. What I think, and this is just my hypothesis here. It's a working hypothesis combining what I understand of what Alan Watt talked about, the priesthoods who bring us religion or who morph the religion into the form it takes for the age, is that there was some kind of a petri dish of these ideas going on with the Inklings. I'm not calling it malignant and I'm not maligning the people who were involved in it. I'm simply saying that because of who they had access to, this was a petri dish for thinking about religion and philosophy, but in particular, religion. And why? Because I will say that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis are using literature to popularize Christianity in a way that hadn't been done before, and really, in a way, hasn't been done since. They were at the highest level of that at that time. And there are a lot of people who have followed in their footsteps, but you could say that was a pinnacle. But also in that group, that now they would have, members were coming out of all kinds of disciplines. But they would be exposed to the thinking and the writing of people like Carl Jung and also Freud. And they would also be exposed to the thinking of any major theologian of that day. We know that the Inklings were exposed to the thinking and writing of Rudolf Steiner, because Owen Barfield was a member of the Inklings, and he was one of the biggest promoters and proponents of the work of Rudolf Steiner. And Rudolf Steiner is, I'm not conversant in his work, so and again, I am not painting any of these men with a brush. I did not know them, but I am talking about the nuance that they brought to religion. And I do think that what Steiner brought to the world, it's been called an organized spirituality. I'm just going to say that I think that anything that gets organized is, in fact, a religion, whether it comes from Hinduism, meditation, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism. When it is organized and it has a body of writing behind it and schools of thought and offshoots, it is a religion. In fact, let's just look up the word religion. We know Alan said ties that bind or to rebind. Here's what the wiki says. It's a range of social cultural systems, including designated behaviors and practices, ethics, morals, beliefs, worldviews, texts, sanctified places, prophecies, organizations that generally relate humanity to supernatural, transcendental, and spiritual elements. So I think all of that was going on through the Inklings. I am not saying that this was nefarious. I'm simply saying that I think that that was what was happening. I will give a couple more reasons for this. Tolkien was working with a body of ideas that related to Catholicism. C.S. Lewis was an avowed atheist who had some experiences that brought him first to deism and then to Christianity. And he stayed a Protestant, even though Tolkien worked on him and wanted him to become Catholic. Owen Barfield, as I said, was a promoter of the work of Rudolf Steiner. And you can look into Steiner's thinking yourself, and I know that it is popular around the world because of his schools and all of the many lectures that he delivered. Now, Owen Barfield was one of C.S. Lewis's very, very, very good friends. And even though they agreed to disagree about the directions that they thought were useful to man's religious experience or man's experience of God, I think I read that Barfield was such a close friend of C.S. Lewis that C.S. Lewis made him his either executor of his estate, or he had something to do with C.S. Lewis's estate. So again, it's easy to be 60 or 80 or 100 years away from something And then you can paint it with a brush and say, oh, that was all bad, or that was all Freemasonic. That's not the point that I'm making here. The point that I'm making is that this group, this environment at Oxford, whether they were chosen by some kingfisher higher up than they ever were or would be, whether they were conscious of what they were bringing to religion or unconscious, whether they were sincere in their conversion experience or insincere, I do not know. And I will not even hazard a guess. What I will say about the writing of C.S. Lewis is that for me, he, to my eyes and ears, he had had some kind of genuine numinous or religious, genuine numinous experience of something transcendent that comes through for me in his writing. What does that mean? It means, I just learned this in talking about Paralandra with Nick when the theologian Greg Gorsuch joined the conversation and brought in Kierkegaard and his own work on perichoresis and the Trinity. It gave me a framework, an intellectual framework, to think about eternity and to think and as a way of talking about God. Now, Kierkegaard said, no man can show another man God. That I learned from Greg Gorsuch, that was given to me by him. So do I see that difficulty? Do I see those challenges in the work of Alan Watt? Yes, I do. The difficulty of having had an experience and then trying to find the words or the framework in which to share your experience. So, does the fact that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were writing this mythopoesis, poesis, this mythical, poetical framework for showing you an experience of something transcendent? Does that mean because they were doing it at Oxford with all of the access that they had to all of these thinkers, does that make it bad? Does it make it not genuine? See, that is what I'm not saying. I'm not that versed in the work of Tolkien. So I don't know if the inner experience shines through in his work. I have not read these things since I was in my teenage years. But with C.S. Lewis, I've said it and I'll say it again, that there is something there that speaks to a genuine experience of the other, of creator, God, the transcendent, the supernatural. And there are people that I know who have gotten a lot from the work of Rudolf Steiner. So I am not saying because he was a member of the OTO or Freemason, I don't know. I don't know what genuine experience he had that informed his work. What I'm saying is that the inklings, what was happening at Oxford at that time, was a hotbed. It was a fertile ground for a discussion about ideas around religion and spirituality. That's all I'm saying. Because of these difficulties, Alan Watt always took us back to the individual, the importance of the individual, the preeminence of your own experience and your own perceptions. And in places in Alan Watt's writing, he says he doesn't need a mediator. That's any mediator. That's any other writer. That's any group. That's any body or text of holy books. He doesn't need that between himself and his experience of something that we would call God or creator. That is not necessary. For him, the danger is when that enters in, then it can come in with a whole host of associations and ideas that dilute, that accrete, like a barnacle, that put something there that isn't necessary, that dilute something really important. I was having a conversation with Nick the other day about Alan talking about baby and bathwater and don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And it was in regards to some of these topics. And Nick said, I don't, what do you mean? And I at the moment in that moment it became very simple for me to say, the bathwater is religion, the baby is the supernatural. So Alan was saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I did a quick search on Alan Watt and supernatural. And it's funny too, because Alan Watts always comes up, and there's Alan Watts with the Buddhism and Zen Buddhism, and it's that explanation then is it's natural, it is contained within this world. Whereas Alan Watt said, say what you will about some of the damage that Malachi Martin did to the Catholic Church. He reinvigorated the idea of the supernatural, and this was important. It can't really be put into proper words for people. I just know that when I read C.S. Lewis's writing, I feel someone who has had that genuine experience. I was having a conversation with a childhood friend of mine who is a Christian. And she said something about the she's been following along to listen to Nick and I discuss these books. And she called him a time traveler. And we have a kind of a shorthand. She would have called Alan, she did call Alan a time traveler. I understand what she means by that. Someone who can go back and forth between the temporal and the eternal. Again, getting a good framework from Greg Gorsuch that his writing about perichoresis and the Trinity have given me, just laywoman's terms for understanding my own experiences and being able even to understand Alan. But my friend said she thought C.S. Lewis was a time traveler. I understand what she means. Someone who can go back and forth between the eternal and the temporal. And for me, C.S. Lewis does that. For me, his writing about the supernatural is the writing that can't be spoon-fed from a Fisher King with more access to the arcane and the archives and, okay, here's no. This is something that springs from within him and his own experience. So I just wanted to share one more thing here. And that is, I can find it here. This is George Orwell. I think I'll do a screen share again here. This is from a website that I stumbled on called A Pilgrim in Narnia and Chronicles of Narnia. That's a C.S. Lewis work that some of you may have read. And so this is George Orwell's review of C.S. Lewis, That Hideous Strength, from the Manchester Evening News, 16 August 1945. George Orwell, and I'm going to do a screen share if I can. Okay. So George Orwell's review of C.S. Lewis, That Hideous Strength, this would have been right when the novel came out. On the whole, novels are better when there are no miracles in them. Still, it is possible to think of a fairly large number of worthwhile books in which ghosts, magic, second sight, angels, mermaids, and whatnot play a part. Mr. C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength can be included in their number, though curiously enough, it would probably have been a better book if the magical element had been left out. For in essence, it is a crime story, and the miraculous happenings, though they grow more frequent towards the end, are not integral to it. In general outline, and to some extent in atmosphere, it rather resembles G.K. Chesterton's The Man Who Was Thursday. Mr. Lewis probably owes something to Chesterton as a writer, and certainly shares his horror of modern machine civilization. The title of the book, by the way, is taken from a poem about the Tower of Babel and his reliance on the eternal verities of the Christian Church as against scientific materialism or nihilism. His book describes the struggle of a little group of sane people against a nightmare that nearly conquers the world, a company of mad scientists, or perhaps they are not mad, but have merely destroyed in themselves all human feeling, all notion of good and evil, are plotting to conquer Britain, then the whole planet, and then other planets, until they have brought the universe under their control. All superfluous life is to be wiped out, all natural forces tamed. The common people are to be used as slaves and vivisection subjects by the ruling caste of scientists, who even see their way to conferring immortal life upon themselves. Man, in short, is to storm the heavens and overthrow the gods, or even become a god himself. There is nothing outrageously improbable in such a conspiracy. Indeed, in a moment when a single atom bomb of a type already pronounced obsolete has just blown probably 300,000 people to fragments, it sounds all too topical. Plenty of people in our age do entertain the monstrous dreams of power that Mr. Lewis attributes to his characters, and we are within sight of the time when such dreams will be realizable. His description of the NICE, the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments, with its worldwide ramifications and its private army, its secret torture chambers, and its inner rings of adepts ruled over by a mysterious personage known as the Head, is as exciting as any detective story. It would be a very hardened reader who would not experience a thrill on learning that the Head is actually, however, that would be giving the game away. One could recommend this book unreservedly if Mr. Lewis had succeeded in keeping it all on a single level. Unfortunately, the supernatural keeps breaking in, and it does so in rather confusing, undisciplined ways. The scientists are endeavoring, among other things, to get hold of the body of the ancient Celtic magician Merlin, who has been buried, not dead, but in a trance for the last 1500 years, in hopes of learning from him the secrets of pre-Christian magic. They are frustrated by a character who is only doubtfully a human being, having spent part of his time on another planet where he has been gifted with eternal youth, that's ransom. Then there is a woman with second sight, one or two ghosts, and various superhuman visitors from outer space, some of them with rather tiresome names, which derive from earlier books of Mr. Lewis's. The book ends in a way that is so preposterous that it does not even succeed in being horrible, in spite of so much bloodshed. Much is made of the fact that the scientists are actually in touch with the evil spirits, although this fact is known only to the inmost circle. Mr. Lewis appears to believe in the existence of such spirits and of benevolent ones as well. He is entitled to his beliefs, but they weaken his story, not only because they offend the average reader's sense of probability, but because, in effect, they decide the issue in advance. When one is told that God and the devil are in conflict, one always knows which side is going to win. The whole drama of the struggle against evil lies in the fact that one does not have supernatural aid. However, by the standard of the novels appearing nowadays, this is a book worth reading. So it's a grudging endorsement, but I'd like it, but take out the supernatural. Whereas with Alan, it's don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I leave it to you to decide for yourself if something that has a supernatural element to it is worth your while, having gotten two-thirds of the way through the book. I just wanted to say that about the Inklings and about the creation of religion, and even of by bringing in Barfield and Steiner, those things that I also think are religion. I mean, I think any of it is. It's, whether you are doing yoga and meditation or, going to mass every Sunday. You can call it a spiritual pursuit. It's fine. And I'm not saying don't do it. That's not the point. So don't miss the point. The point is that that experience, which turns your life upside down, and Greg Gorsuch shared the fact that he had had such an experience, that experience that turns your life inside out, upside down, as the character Jane says here in That Hideous Strength, her world had been unmade. That was just the beginning of her journey. That is part of an individual's solo, unique journey. And so we all pull from things. Our childhood, the way we were raised, a religion, schools of thought, disciplines that we've become involved with, whether it is Zen Buddhism or yoga, whatever it is, that's what you're doing on your personal journey. And as my same childhood friend, who said that she thought that C.S. Lewis was a time traveler, and by the way, so was Alan Watt, says, I love this. She says, you do you. So you do you. I'm not here to knock that. I am simply saying that when we read and study and think or practice, just to be aware of what it is we're doing. If you like being a religious person and going to mass on Sunday, I'm not taking that away from you. I was profoundly moved by the real history that I did with Christine a couple of weeks ago, and she shared the experience that she had at the statue her mother-in-law had of the Virgin Mary in the backyard when she was due to deliver, and saying, all I want is a healthy baby. And 2 days later, she had that fall down the stairs, which led to her whole plan going out of control. Her whole plan was that her midwife was going to help her deliver at home, and there'd be no medical intervention, and that was the plan. And what happened was the sliding down on her backside on the stairs meant that she was told they had to go to the hospital and be checked out. And that checking out led to dot, 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 dot. And then she had a C-section. And it was at that point that her midwife came in and said, I am here to tell you that if this had not happened, you would have delivered a stillborn baby. This is what has happened. And so she didn't. She had her miracle baby that she prayed for in the backyard at the statue of the Virgin Mary. And I don't believe her. I know that that is what happened. So it's only when we get to be unique individuals on our own journey that this moving between the eternal and the temporal has a place to happen, has a place to occur. So my whole point here is not to say religion bad and any spiritual practice that's organized bad. No. Just saying it's your journey. Don't make a god out of anyone else. All right, I think I am going to give an audio version of Julian Huxley, starting with Thomas Huxley and his 1893, what was that one called? 1893, Evolution and Ethics, and then the 1943 by Julian Huxley, Evolutionary Ethics, the Romaines Lectures. And I will drop those off somewhere for you that if you're interested, you can listen to them. I'll also link. So if you don't like listening to an audiobook version, then you can read it yourself. But yes, that was the point that I was making, is that some people don't like it when I talk about the woo, but I think I'm all about the woo. And it's very hard for me not to talk about that. And by that, I mean my own experiences. I mean, I got to walk out of my life and go be with Alan Watt. That's a little bit woo, if you think about it. So it's something happens. And when that something happens, for some people, what they do, and Greg Gorsuch even talked about that. What did he do when that happened? He processed it and has been processing it for the last 50 years within the framework of Christianity. These experiences that Alan had, from knowing him, that he tested them out against different frameworks and ultimately came to the conclusion that there was nothing out there that satisfactorily gave him a home to set the experiences in and then hang things on it and say, that is it. This describes it. This is what happened to me. And so that's why I felt like I wanted to talk a little bit about the Inklings and Oxford and academia and the Romaines lectures and the kind of the academic petri dish that has been so important for hundreds of years in the creation and dissemination of religions. And now in this postmodern world, the deconstruction of them.